KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. We'll have live special coverage of President Trump's remarks at the NATO summit, where European leaders announced increases to their defense spending to counter threats from Russia and China. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. A new group of vaccine advisors to the CDC meets today. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. It's their first meeting after Health Secretary RFK Jr. fired all the members of the old panel. Critics say some members of the new panel aren't qualified or are biased. Also, a new biography of the late Virgil Abloh tells the story of how a fashion outsider made it to the top of the world's largest luxury brand. It is Wednesday, June 25th. On this day in 1996, Jay-Z released his debut album, Reasonable Doubt. It was not considered an immediate success, but critics now call it a classic. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Trump met with reporters at the NATO summit in The Hague. He's praised other NATO leaders for agreeing to significantly hike their defense spending. Each country is to boost spending by 5% of their GDP every year. These hikes are to start within a decade, although Spain has suggested it may not do this. Trump also says the U.S. strikes on Iranian nuclear sites last weekend brought an end to the Iran-Israel war. He says the U.S. destroyed one Iranian site, although a preliminary report on damage isn't yet clear.
Now, this is also, Iran made the statement, and it's also, if you read the document that was given, that Pete can talk about if you'd like, the document said it could be very severe damage, but they didn't take that. They said it could be limited or it could be very severe. They really didn't know, other than to say it could be limited or it could be very, very severe.
Trump said U.S. officials would speak to Iran next week. A monthly poll by the American Psychiatric Association finds a majority of respondents believe climate change is hurting people's mental health. As NPR's Ritu Chatterjee reports, the poll also found younger respondents were more likely to recognize that than older adults.
The poll surveyed more than 2,000 adults across the country. 55% of those respondents said they believe climate change is adversely affecting Americans' mental health. More than 40% said they were personally affected. One in three said they worry about climate change on a weekly basis and that it's a significant source of stress for them. 18 to 34-year-olds were significantly more likely compared to those 65 and older to report that they feel personally affected and feel anxious about governmental response to climate change. Parents were also more likely than non-parents to report the same. Only 4% of respondents said they don't believe climate change exists. Ritu Chatterjee, NPR News.
Most results are in from New York City's Democratic primary for mayor. Former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo has conceded to state assembly member Zoran Mamdani. NPR's Sarah Venturi reports Mamdani's campaign galvanized support, particularly among young New Yorkers.
Mamdani campaigned on issues of affordability. He promises a rent freeze for those in rent-stabilized housing, the elimination of bus fares, and even a network of city-owned grocery stores. In a speech to his supporters after Cuomo's concession, the 33-year-old Democratic Socialist said,
"A life of dignity should not be reserved for a fortunate few. It should be one that city government guarantees for each and every New Yorker."
Once confirmed as the Democratic nominee, he'll face off against Republican Curtis Sliwa and sitting Mayor Eric Adams, who's running as an independent, in the November election. Sarah Ventry, NPR News, New York.
On Wall Street, Dow Jones Industrials are down about 63 points. This is NPR. A man charged in connection with the fertility clinic bombing in Palm Springs, California, has died in federal custody. Daniel Park was being held on charges that he supplied large amounts of chemicals used in the attack. From member station KVCR in San Bernardino, Madison Allman reports.
Park was charged earlier this month for allegedly mailing some 270 pounds of ammonium nitrate to the FBI's main suspect in the bombing, Guy Edward Bart case. Bark has detonated a car bomb outside the clinic that was felt for blocks. He was the only person that died in what federal prosecutors called a suicidal terror attack. The FBI has not said how Park and Bartkus knew each other, but have said they shared a fringe ideology called pro-mortalism, the belief that people should not exist. The Federal Bureau of Prisons has not said how Park died. Their statement said Park was found unresponsive in his cell at the Metropolitan Detention Center in Los Angeles and declared dead at a hospital. For NPR News, I'm Madison Ament.
Federal safety investigators are asking Tesla about the launch of its new robo-taxi service in Austin, Texas last weekend. About 10 cars began service. Some news reports suggest a couple of the driverless cars behaved erratically and may not have followed all traffic laws. Four astronauts blasted off from Florida overnight aboard a SpaceX rocket. They're headed for the International Space Station. The mission is commanded by former NASA astronaut Peggy Whitson. Tonight's the first round of the NBA draft in Brooklyn. The Dallas Mavericks will pick first. The star player from Duke, Cooper Flagg, is expected to be the first choice. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at CIDQ.org/NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California. President Trump says his administration will be meeting with Iranian officials next week. At the NATO summit in the Netherlands, where the president is meeting with European leaders, Trump defended his strikes on nuclear sites in Iran. Here to discuss the latest intelligence assessments and Trump's press conference, we're joined by NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie. So, Greg, how did Trump describe the ceasefire between Iran and Israel?
Well, he says the war is over. He called it the 12-day war. He said both sides were exhausted. There's ample evidence so far to support that view. Life seems to be returning to normal in Israel. A lot of Israelis got stuck overseas because the airport was closed. The airport is reopening. They're flying home in large numbers. Iran had a big rally yesterday. Some senior officials were out among the crowd. Life is also returning to normal there. But I would stress that we have seen this kind of thing in the past in other Mideast conflicts. You'll have this short, brief, intense battle, then a ceasefire, but it doesn't really solve any of the underlying problems. So we don't know, you know, if this is going to hold temporarily or for the longer term. But he did note, as you said, that the U.S. is going to be talking to Iran next week. So at least they're going to be discussing things. But it's not clear that anything has really been decided on the political front.
Right. When questioned, he did say that he guesses it could start again soon. So we'll see where that goes. The president also repeated his claim that Iran's nuclear program was, quote, obliterated. What are we hearing, though, from other sources?
Yeah. So there has been a bit of a range, quite frankly. The thing that has the president very agitated is a report from the Defense Intelligence Agency. An official has spoken to NPR about this and to other news organizations. That report says says that the damage to Iran's nuclear sites from the U.S. strike over the weekend was limited, that Iran's program may be set back a few months, but it's not completely destroyed, as the president has suggested. Now, Trump is very upset about that. We're hearing some other voices today. An Iranian foreign ministry spokesman was quoted as saying that the country's nuclear facilities were badly damaged. And Israel's Atomic Energy Commission put out a statement saying that they believe Iran's ability to develop nuclear weapons has been set back by many years. So these assessments are more an art than a science, and we're going to keep getting them. The one I referenced in the U.S. is really a preliminary one, and then the more will be coming out, and we'll have to see what they say, but more information will be being gathered as we speak.
Sure. Now, the president also met with Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky. Any sense that something or anything might be happening on the Russia-Ukraine front?
Nothing specific in terms of commitments, but certainly in tone. Trump said Zelensky couldn't have been nicer. They got along well, and obviously that contrasts with the difficult meeting they had at the White House earlier in the year. Trump also said he's been speaking to Putin. He will speak to Putin. He said Putin has been difficult. He's had some problems with Zelensky. But at the core issues, the intensity of this war has only increased as Russia has ramped up strikes. And Trump didn't make any commitment to providing additional assistance to Ukraine.
All right. That's NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie. Greg, thanks a lot.
Sure thing, eh?
Democrats were fuming after the White House postponed two briefings about those U.S. strikes on Iran's nuclear program. A briefing is now scheduled to take place tomorrow for senators and on Friday for members of the House. The top Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, Mark Warner of Virginia, told All Things Considered last night he has a lot of questions.
What next if you don't take them out all on the first strike? What are the next steps? How do we make sure that there's not Iran racing now to a dirty bomb? These are questions that we, and frankly, the American people, deserve answers to.
Let's hear from another lawmaker on one of the Intelligence Committees, Congressman Mike Quigley of Illinois. He's a Democrat and serving on the House Intelligence Committee. Good morning, Congressman. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you.
So you heard Senator Warner's questions. Do you have any others?
I think they have to own up to the fact that the truth matters. Just the fact that the president's ego may be dinged by the fact that his initial statements weren't correct, it really doesn't matter. You got to put your ego in your pocket. You have to face the threats as they exist, not as the president's ego maintains.
Do you have any visibility yourself into the extent of the damage done to Iran's nuclear capabilities?
Look, I've been briefed on this as a member of the Intel Committee. We're going to get another briefing Friday morning before the full House gets briefed. And the fact that things may have been leaked doesn't mean that they're not still classified. But what I can say is, look, I've been on the committee 8 years. These strikes are very difficult to evaluate, especially in a denied area. It takes time. These are difficult, hard targets. They're mobile targets. To say they were obliterated before any analysis is fanciful and frankly dangerous. And the IAEA also, beyond saying there were 900 pounds, they said there's probably 30 sites. So what I tried to do was just to make this bipartisan and honest. Senator and Chairman McCall said, I've been briefed on this plan in the past, and it was never meant to completely destroy the facilities, but rather cause significant damage. It was always known to be a temporary setback. Well, I'll add to that. I've been briefed on this many, many times, this kind of plan, on an unclassified basis as well. It was also clear that you were never going to end this program unless you have troops on the ground, and that means a war. So by abandoning diplomacy and the fact that Iran was in compliance before, the president has, in fact, made the situation more dangerous.
Gosh, I have so many questions that we don't have time to answer here, but I was wondering why you think there's such a discrepancy between the administration's version of events and those of the intelligence community. And was it the administration's objective to obliterate the nuclear program? It sounds to me like you're saying, from what you understand, that that just would never have been the case.
What I'm saying is you don't have to read any leaked report or believe that it exists or not. you just know that you cannot obliterate the program with simple missile strikes. And that's what we have acknowledged all along. So what we're facing here is a president, and why we're in this situation, he refuses to ever admit that he's wrong. He wants to be able to say, this is all over and let's move on. It's not that neat. And when you try to do what the president is doing, you put us in a more dangerous situation because we're not dealing with the true threat. A real threat that has to be addressed. It was addressed before diplomatically. It was working. And it's his fault we are now in this situation.
So what would you like to see now? We have about a minute left here. What does the U.S. need to do now, in your opinion?
Look, a true assessment. And in the final analysis, we have to move back to diplomacy. There's a lot of things that can move us toward that. Iran is in a weakened state, as are their proxies. Now is the time to push again for diplomacy. It's the only thing that's ever worked. It's the only thing that will work.
That is Congressman Mike Quigley of Illinois. He is a Democrat, and he's a member of the House Intelligence Committee. Congressman Quigley, thanks so much for sharing these insights with us.
Thank you.
I do want to mention that NPR reached out to multiple Republican members of the House and Senate, including those on the intelligence committees, who either declined to be interviewed or did not respond.
Now we take a look at Gaza, where the health ministry there says the number of Palestinians killed in Israeli attacks surpassed 56,000 people, a third of them children. Despite the bloodshed, Gaza's war has fallen out of view in recent days, overshadowed by Israel's war with Iran. NPR's Eya Batraoui in Dubai and Anas Baba in Gaza have more on what people there are saying.
It took just 12 days from the start of Israel's surprise attack on Iran for the war between the two to be called off, with a ceasefire announced by President Trump this week. But it's now day 627 of Israel's war in Gaza, and there are no signs of it winding down or ending. In only the past 24 hours, 7 Israeli soldiers were killed, and Gaza's health ministry says more than 90 Palestinians were killed, a third of them shot dead by Israeli forces trying to get food amid severe Israeli restrictions on aid in the territory. Israel's military says it's reviewing some of those shootings. On the ruined, bombed-out streets of Gaza, people have lost hope. Khalil al-Najjar says upon hearing of a ceasefire between Israel and Iran, he said it felt like people in Gaza aren't seen as human, that there's no humanity in the world. He says Gaza's been forgotten and forsaken. That sentiment was echoed by Akram Tabash, who's out of work and going hungry. UN-backed experts on hunger say Gaza is at risk of famine. He says Iran, which supports Hamas, turned its back on the group when it clinched a ceasefire deal with Israel without conditions that the war in Gaza also end. He says he expects Israel's military to strike Gaza even harder now and issue more sweeping evacuation orders. The UN says more than 80% of Gaza is inaccessible to Palestinians or under displacement order by Israel's military. Families of Israeli hostages captured by Hamas in its 2023 attack on Israel say now is the time for a deal that brings them all home and ends the war, saying the government should seize this critical moment. But Israel's far-right government has shown no willingness to permanently end the war. It says Gaza must first be disarmed and Hamas defeated, an elusive and broad war aim that's kept a ceasefire out of reach. Eya Batraoui, NPR News Dubai, with Anas Baba in Gaza.
This is NPR News.
This week, on the next Fresh Air, we speak with actor Eben Moss Bachrach. He's won 2 Emmys for his portrayal of Cousin Richie. He's also appeared in the shows Girls and The Punisher. Next month, he co-stars in the new Marvel movie, The Fantastic Four: First Steps. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, dedicated to improving the learning experience for America's students by sharing what works in pre-K through 12 education at edutopia.org. From the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at lemelson.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. If I say luxury, especially luxury fashion, what comes to mind? Rich people? Check. Jet-setting celebrities? Sure. So how was it that a streetwear-loving black kid from the outskirts of Chicago with no formal training in fashion became an artistic director at the world's largest luxury brand? Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Robin Givhan has a new book that tells the remarkable story of the late Virgil Abloh, who, before his untimely death in 2021, took streetwear and the career of a fashion outsider to new heights. Givhan's new book is Make It Ours, Crashing the Gates of Culture with Virgil Abloh. And she's with us now to tell us more about it. Good morning, Robin.
Thank you for having me, Michelle.
Why was he such a big deal?
You know, he was a big deal because he was so unusual, because he had not apprenticed at a multitude of fashion houses. He had not studied fashion design. And he really came from the world of T-shirts and hip-hop and streetwear. But what he did that was so unusual is normally a company starts out with a garment and they build a brand around the garment. Virgil created a brand and then he proceeded to put products underneath the brand. And because the brand was so powerful, he was able to kind of inject meaning into those products. And it made the people who purchased the products feel seen and feel like their perspective about what was valuable, what was beautiful, was being heard at the highest levels.
Was he kind of the precursor of the celebrity brand in some way, creating a sense of belonging through wearing a garment? You know what I mean? I wear this, mm-hmm. therefore I am connected to all these other people who like the same thing I like.
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways he was even better than a celebrity brand. I mean, he was known because he had been an assistant for Kanye West. He was known because he had such an enormous social media presence and because he DJed. But he wasn't really sort of the classic celebrity. And still, he was able to create a brand called Off-White. And he made it so meaningful to people that it didn't really matter that the clothes that came out underneath the brand weren't necessarily that unique. I mean, Off-White was really known for hazard lines, for putting words in quotation marks, for these little red zip ties that were on the sneakers that he made. That's how you really knew who had made the product. It wasn't necessarily the style of the sneaker. It was the zip tie. It wasn't necessarily the cut of the varsity jacket. It was that it had these hazard stripes on the back.
And that was controversial because there were some people who thought that he really wasn't. Well, he didn't call himself a designer, right? He called himself a creator or a maker, but he did have his critics, people who thought that you're really not doing anything new here.
I mean, when I was covering his collections, I was one of those critics.
So give us the short version of how Abloh went from an engineering and architecture student from Rockford, Illinois, to become the first black artistic director at the world's largest luxury brand, which is Louis Vuitton.
Yeah, he started out having this sort of serendipitous meeting with Kanye West and sort of got swept up in that circle of people who were wildly ambitious and deeply interested in design. Eventually, he dabbled with his sort of first big t-shirt success with something called Bentril, which was really t-shirts that were made by a DJ collective. And that really informed the way that he worked, this idea that you didn't have to necessarily write the melody or the lyrics. You could take pre-existing ideas and mix them together in new ways and call that your design, so to speak. And then from there, he bought dead stock from Ralph Lauren Rugby, and he silkscreened Pyrex 23 on the back. The original shirt sold for about $40. He sold his versions for over $500.
Oh my goodness.
And they sold out.
How did he become artistic director at Louis Vuitton?
What I think really sort of propelled him into the sight lines of the folks at Vuitton was when he did a collaboration with Nike. And Nike wanted to reissue 10 of their most recognized sneaker styles. And he ended up being responsible for all 10 of these redesigns. You know, Nike is so enormous. It is more recognized than Vuitton as a brand. And when there's a success there, it really reverberates. And that caught the attention of Vuitton.
He died at a very young age, at 41, from a rare form of cancer. He had to have known that his time was short. Do you have a sense of what he thinks his legacy would be?
One of the things that was really remarkable to me, I was able to listen to an interview that Virgil had done back in 2008. And he was talking about how he wanted to mentor people. But even at that early stage of his career, he was thinking about mentoring. And he did that throughout his career. And of course, he also established a scholarship that eventually became part of his legacy.
You're a distinguished fashion writer and a distinguished critic. But inevitably, when we have these conversations about fashion, the question arises, so what? Why do we care about a Virgil Abloh?
Yeah, I mean, we care about Virgil because at the very smallest level, there are kids out there who are making t-shirts or maybe putting stickers on baseball caps. And they love design, they love art, and he is proof that you can take something that simple, gestures that simple, and you can lean into them, and just because you don't have the training or the classical background or all the access that you think you need, that you can still get pretty far in the fashion industry.
That is the Pulitzer Prize-winning writer, Robin Givens. She's senior critic-at-large at The Washington Post. Her latest book is Make It Ours, Crashing the Gates of Culture with Virgil Abloh. Robin, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
The Trump administration wants to strip the name of civil rights icon Harvey Milk from a Navy ship, which critics worry is part of a larger backlash against the LGBTQ community.
It seems extremely vindictive. It's almost as if they want to impact pain on these individuals. And it's just very, very unfortunate.
That story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Kristen Wright. President Trump is reaffirming his previous statements describing U.S. strikes against nuclear sites in Iran as obliteration, setting back Iran's enrichment program many years. Speaking from the NATO summit in The Hague, Trump said the infrastructure at one site is totally inoperable. NPR's Greg Myrie reports Trump is citing an Israeli damage assessment and dismissing preliminary reports from U.S. intelligence officials.
assessing sites that have been bombed is really an art, not a science. And in the U.S., we've seen preliminary reports come out saying that there was damage, but it's limited damage. Trump insisting defensively that there was an obliteration. We're seeing some comments from Iran saying, acknowledging that there was great damage.
The president also says he's confident the conflict between Israel and Iran is over. He says he'll talk with Iranian officials next week. A heat wave is still bearing down on the central and eastern half of the U.S. Bharat Venkat is with UCLA's heat lab.
When it gets really humid, our bodies have a really hard time cooling down. The sweat that we produce doesn't evaporate, and so the heat gets retained in our bodies. So it really puts us at kind of greater risk of experiencing heat-related illness or even death.
The heat is expected to last through the end of the week. This is NPR News. The race for the Democratic nomination for New York City mayor has yet to be officially called. But State Assemblyman Zohran Mamdani is declaring victory. NPR's Giles Snyder reports former Governor Andrew Cuomo's attempt at a comeback has been dealt a setback.
Andrew Cuomo was seeking a return to politics 4 years after resigning as New York governor amid sexual harassment allegations, but he ended up conceding the Democratic primary for mayor, telling supporters that Zohran Mamdani conducted a great campaign.
I called him. I congratulated him. I applaud him sincerely for his effort, and let's give him a round of applause.
The ultimate outcome will not be final until next week due to New York City's ranked choice voting process. Cuomo's concession does not necessarily mean he's completely out of the running. He's already qualified as an independent in the November election. Giles Snyder, NPR News.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's new vaccine advisory committee begins its two-day meeting today. It's the panel's first meeting since Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. removed all 17 members and replaced them with a smaller group. The new members include people who have a record of questioning the safety of vaccines and spreading false claims about them. The committee helps make federal vaccine policy. I'm Kristen Wright, and this is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at RaymondJames.com. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. The NATO summit wraps up today with most members promising to dramatically increase their defense spending. President Trump attended. He gave a long and wide-ranging press conference with the media afterwards. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley was at The Hague at the NATO summit, and we go to her now for her thoughts on this. Eleanor, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome, Michelle.
So first of all, what have the NATO allies decided? What have they done?
Well, in a very short communique, they pledged to increase their defense spending from 2% of gross domestic product to 5%. This is a huge step. And they repeated their commitment to Article 5, which is the underlying basis for NATO. It means all allies promise to protect the one that is attacked. There were concerns President Trump was not committed to that, but he agreed. He said today he was, and he agreed to the communique, which means he's bound by it. Overall, it ended on a good vibe, I would say, with no open divisions, lots of the 32 national leaders speaking of solidarity and unity behind the NATO allies.
And what did President Trump say?
Oh, Michelle, what did he not say? He had this long press conference that went on for over an hour, and let's see, he kind of glossed over the war in Ukraine, saying it was a lot more complicated than people realized to end, and that Russian President Vladimir Putin was a lot more difficult than he thought. He had a lot of great statements of love and bonhomie for the Netherlands and his NATO allies, and he took credit for the NATO members increasing their defense budgets. But he mostly talked about the U.S. strikes on Iranian nuclear sites, how devastating and effective they had been. And he complained bitterly about what he called fake news media trying to say that the nuclear weapons were not destroyed, or the process wasn't destroyed. And he came back to this time and again. He seemed angry. He called it an attack against the brave pilots who flew the missions. Let's listen to an excerpt.
When I saw them starting to question the caliber of the attack, was it bad? Well, it was really bad. It was devastating. They were obliterated. In fact, you can't get into the tunnels. They just put that over. That just came out. They can't. There's nothing. There's no way you can even get down. The whole thing is collapsed in a disaster.
Yes, he was very much preoccupied with this, and as you noted, tried to sort of pivot the skepticism about whether the nuclear program was destroyed to a criticism of the pilots. So, but speaking of disasters, there were fears in advance of the summit that this one might be one. So, looking back on it, was it?
No, it was a success. I mean, many of the alliance members have hailed Trump for getting NATO to increase spending. And of course, the main reason for that is Russia's attack on Ukraine. But they say the pressure he put played a huge role. The strike on Iran, of course, changed the focus a little bit. You know, Secretary General Mark Rutte said Trump had made Europe and Canada realize they weren't paying their fair share, and now they would. And he was very complimentary of Trump about this, you know, NATO and the strikes on Iran's nuclear facilities, which he called extraordinary. Let's listen to Rutte.
I think it is a man of strength, but also a man of peace. You've seen that basically now with Iran, the man of strength being able to command his B-2 bombers to go into Iran to take out that nuclear capability, but also the man of peace, who is then immediately following up with making sure that Israel and Iran will commit to a ceasefire.
So, you know, Trump says he's going home a different person. He said he saw leaders who love their countries. He's talking about the Europeans. And he says now he understands better how important, you know, it is for NATO to be strong.
That is NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reporting on the NATO summit at The Hague in the Netherlands. Eleanor, thank you.
Thank you, Michelle.
An influential committee of vaccine advisors to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention begins a two-day meeting in Atlanta this morning. Now, the panel often meets in obscurity, but now it's in the spotlight. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. fired the previous panel members 2 weeks ago and named replacements. NPR's Ping Wong joins us now to talk about what's at stake. So, Ping, some people may have first heard about this committee when RFK Jr. fired all 17 of its members. Can you tell us what this group actually does?
Yeah. Absolutely. It's called the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, and usually they meet about 3 times a year. And these are advisors that make recommendations to CDC on how vaccines that have been already approved by the Food and Drug Administration, how those vaccines should be used to protect public health, you know, like who should get which vaccines and when, and their votes affect what insurers cover and what kids have access to. Now, their meetings, like the one that starts today, have to be public, and that's meant to build trust in vaccine recommendations, which are then ultimately made by the CDC's director.
So what's supposed to happen at today's meeting?
Okay, so they're usually really predictable, but this meeting is going to be pretty different.
Oh boy.
And that's because RFK Jr. has replaced the entire panel. It's a move that he said that he made to restore public trust. But I talked with a former CDC official named Dr. Fiona Havers, and in the past, she's presented at these meetings and she's helped support them, but she quit the agency last week after RFK Jr.'s purge of the panel. She thinks that's a move that undermined trust.
I knew I was done at that moment. I did not feel, for my own scientific and personal integrity, that I could present to this committee and help legitimize them.
Wow, okay. So what can we tell from who RFK Jr. has named to be on the committee?
So there's new members, and many of them do not actually have deep expertise in vaccines. In fact, some of them rose to prominence in recent years by spreading misinformation about them. So, for instance, there's Retzef Levy, who's a professor at MIT. He has said on social media that COVID vaccines are killing young people and must be stopped. Dr. Robert Malone has suggested that COVID vaccines may cause cancer. To be super clear, neither of these claims check out as facts. And Malone and another new member, Martin Kulldorff, have also both been paid to serve as expert witnesses in litigation against the vaccine maker Merck. So vaccine advocates are worried that this panel could be dismissive of vaccines, even discourage their use. And there's already a few things on the agenda that they point to that have long been priorities for people who question vaccines.
Ooh, like what are those?
Okay, so there's a vote scheduled over thimerosal, which is a preservative used in influenza vaccines. So back in the mid to late 90s, there were theories that thimerosal could be a cause of autism in children. That claim has long been debunked, but, you know, even so, manufacturers have voluntarily removed it from childhood vaccines. It's used infrequently today, and there hasn't been much new research on it for years, but it is still listed as something the group is going to consider. Also, there's going to be a discussion of the MMRV vaccine. That's a combo vaccine for measles, mumps, rubella, and varicella, or chickenpox. Now, years ago, there was evidence that it was linked with seizures during fevers in some young children, and the committee addressed it then by recommending that young kids be vaccinated separately for chickenpox. That is a recommendation that hasn't changed in 15 years, but it's now also on the agenda for discussion. So this is going to be a very closely watched meeting, and how it goes could say a lot about where the nation's vaccine policy is headed.
All right, that's NPR health correspondent Ping Wong. Thanks for the heads up.
You're welcome.
This is NPR News.
A ProPublica investigation finds the FDA allowed foreign factories to send tainted prescription drugs to American patients. That's next time on Here and Now.
News stories do not wait to unfold. They just happen. And when they do, no matter where you are, NPR helps you stay connected. Listen live at this station's website or npr.org on your phone.
Good morning, I'm Michelle Martin. Alarm clock, wake-up call, so passé. A Chinese hotel has another way of waking up their guests, a red panda. Think raccoon, but maybe a little cuter and red. The hotel brings one of their four resident red pandas to your room, and with the aid of apple chunks, lets it climb onto your bed. Guests love it, local officials don't. The Forestry Bureau has asked the hotel to stop, citing concerns about safety and animal welfare. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Martinez. A banner in Venice this week showed the laughing face of Amazon founder Jeff Bezos blown up to giant proportions and spread across a plaza in Venice, Italy. Above the image, activists put the words, "If you can rent Venice for your wedding, you can pay more tax." It's one of several efforts meant to protest or even disrupt Bezos' wedding to Lauren Sanchez this week. Tabloids report the celebrations have already begun. People magazine, for example, published pictures of the couple at a foam-filled party on Bezos' superyacht. The Wall Street Journal's Margherita Sancati is also reporting on the wedding buildup and joins us now from Rome. So a big destination wedding with one of the world's richest people. What do we know about the festivities and who's going to be there?
So we know very little because this event has been shrouded in secrecy. Wedding organizers have been extremely diligent about keeping the details of the wedding under wraps. But we do know it will be at least a three-day affair and mostly running from Thursday to Saturday. We know it's going to be a star-studded event that will happen across the city's tiny islands. And some of the guests are here already. We've seen images of Ivanka Trump and her husband, Jared Kushner, and their kids. We have at least one super yacht moored in the city. And we know there will be about 200 guests.
Okay, I've seen a DiCaprio sighting. I've seen a Kardashian sighting. So, yeah, definitely a star-studded event in Venice. So tell me, though, I mean, so why do activists want to disrupt the whole thing in the first place?
So Venetians are upset because they are tired of their city being used as a backdrop for luxury events, and also because it reinforces this image of Venice essentially as a playground for tourists. So it's not just about Jeff Bezos. It's about how the city has transformed and how it continues to transform. Venetians have an ambivalent relationship with tourism. The city's economy entirely depends on it. But residents say that they feel outnumbered, and they literally are. You know, on an average day, tourists far outnumber the people who actually live there. And they're pushing back against this image of Venice as a theme park. And by the way, some tourists literally think Venice is a theme park. And they've asked locals questions such as, you know, where is the exit and what time does it close?
I wish that weren't true, but I can totally picture tourists thinking that Venice is an actual theme park. Wow. All right. So what do wedding planners and the local government have to say about all this?
So the local government is really upset that these activists are threatening to disrupt the celebration because they're really in favor of this particular event, but also of this kind of tourism. You know, they want to encourage high net worth individuals from spending time and money in Venice. What they don't want, you know, day trippers who maybe spend 2 hours in Venice and leave just with a sandwich in their hands. So they're worried about the damage this could do to Venice's image and that it could discourage high net worth individuals from coming to the city.
You mentioned how Venice relies on tourism, but is there any concern about over tourism in Venice?
Absolutely. You know, the population of Venice is around 50,000 people, and most days tourists far outnumber that. And to tackle overtourism, the local government last year actually introduced a daily entry fee on busy days. But, you know, it has done little to dissuade visitors from descending en masse on the city. And if anything, residents complain, it actually reinforces this perception of Venice as a theme park.
All right, that's Margherita Stancati of the Wall Street Journal from Rome. Margherita, thanks.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. A remarkable and unusual scene took place outside a Massachusetts courtroom last week. Hundreds of people, many wearing pink T-shirts, erupted into cheers and tears upon news of a verdict. They were there to support a woman named Karen Reed, who'd been accused of killing her Boston police officer boyfriend with her SUV during a snowy January night in 2022. Why the strong reaction? Well, some had been persuaded by the defense theory that the boyfriend had actually been killed by fellow cops, who then conspired to frame Reed. But others who followed the case said some of the reaction was due to outrage at unprofessional conduct by police during the investigation, including notably from the lead investigator, Michael Proctor. So does this case tell us anything about the public's trust in law enforcement? I asked David Sarney this. He's a retired NYPD detective and adjunct professor at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, who teaches police ethics, among other courses.
Unfortunately, there are a lot of, and I'm not going to say unethical, but you're looking at some things that were, you know, the investigator, unfortunately, from an outsider point of view, put himself in an unprofessional demeanor between the text messages to his friends. You know, the professional protocols may not have been established properly, the chain of custody, the recovery of evidence, all those things came into play.
Let me just back up here for people who did not follow this as closely as other people did, that some of the things that stood out were just, first of all, the way the evidence was collected, using a leaf blower to clear snow away from the scene. People questioned, gee, did that disrupt evidence? Investigators didn't search the house. But what was most damning was these text messages that the lead investigator sent to friends. At the first trial, he had to read them aloud. He disparaged Karen Reed. He mocked her. He suggested that, you know, he hoped that she would kill herself. So you don't think that was unethical?
Here's the issue is, if you're the lead investigator, you have to be beyond reproach. And the key to everything is, it's an unbiased investigation. You have to determine by the totality of circumstances and the facts available. When you start disparaging victims and perpetrators and subjects and along those lines, it decimates your credibility. It decimates your unbiased operation of the investigation.
Do you think there's a broader issue here with the way the public views law enforcement? Because in recent years, there have been a number of these high profile cases where police conduct has been an issue. I mean, obviously, in the case of George Floyd or the case of Tamir Rice, this 12-year-old was playing with a BB gun and then the police shot him within like literally minutes of coming upon him. And I just wonder, do you think that there's a broader issue here of credibility that has been eroded by these cases of police misconduct?
Well, when you see these things, you'll see an erosion. You will see that because high profile cases, videos that come out without any context, people make these decisions based on 15, 20 seconds, 30 seconds of video. And that's the thing, the totality of the investigation, the totality of the incident that takes place. The Tamir Rice, yeah, and these, you know, we talk about issues of use of deadly force. And in this case, you know, split second decisions are made and let the investigation happen. That's, unfortunately, we have lost that because the court of public opinion is much faster to respond to that. That's why when it comes to this investigation, the Karen Reed trial and the Karen Reed case, it is specific to the Commonwealth. It's specific to the Karen Reed investigation. But you will see investigations that take place in other places, Connecticut, New York City, New York State, where investigators are beyond reproach. Their investigations are honorable, respectful, but you don't get the media coverage for that.
Is there something that you will draw from this going forward as you continue to teach police procedure?
I want to always make sure that people who are going to law enforcement, who need to understand law enforcement, understand the whole process. And if you're going into the position of a police officer, if you're going that, you should know the good and bad side of it. It's a very positive job. It's a profession. If you treat it as such, if you bring the attitude and effort to do it the right way, in every sense of the way, and that's really what it comes down to.
That's David Sarney. He's a retired NYPD detective, and he's a professor at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Professor Sarney, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you very much, and take care.
People across the U.S. are currently sweating through a heat wave. Maine and other northern states like it has been considered a climate refuge in recent years. But Maine Public Radio's Molly Enking reports it didn't feel like much of a refuge yesterday.
At a pick-your-own strawberry farm on a hillside in the small town of Pownall, Maine, it's 10 a.m. and 95 degrees. Out front, a farm stand holds a dozen pints of huge, red, ripe berries. Farmer Dwight Ely is already done with his day. Not because he wants to be, but because in this unusual heat, he has to be.
Our day started about 5 o'clock because we wanted to get out here and get the irrigation system going and pick some berries ourselves early so that we'd have them on the stand.
And prepare to welcome customers.
Almost all of them are regulars, yeah.
Who, despite the heat, showed up to pick their own by 7 a.m.
If I may say, the picking is good enough so that nobody was here that long.
By 10, it's too hot to continue. Ely and his farm manager put up a sign, Bradbury Mountain Berry Farm's Pick Your Own is done for the day. They cover the crop of strawberries with plastic shade cloth and hope for the best. This year, these berries have seen it all. Drought in the winter, an extremely rainy spring, unseasonably late frost, and now Ely's hoping they survive this extreme heat too.
I don't know if the plants will die, but the berries certainly will cook. Nothing we can do about it. The plants that are coming into production, they usually have a little bit more energy, and so I think they're gonna be okay. We'll find out.
At a popular state park down the road from the strawberry farm, the playground and parking lot sit empty. But it's another story the next town over on the coast, at Winslow State Park in Freeport, says Kendra Williams, who works at the front gate.
Today it's been really busy, yeah.
By now, it's 96 degrees, and the humidity is making it feel worse. Much like wind chill will make a cold day feel even colder, high humidity can make 96 feel like...
Live special coverage from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. In a minute, President Trump will take questions from reporters at a press conference at The Hague, where he's been participating in the NATO summit. This is happening while the world watches to see whether a ceasefire between Israel and Iran will last. And on the heels of U.S. strikes in Iran nuclear facilities, let's go to the president right now.
Please. In fact, I want to bring some back with me. I want to also thank, I had breakfast this morning with the king and queen and their incredible people. I said, you're central casting, beautiful people, great people, big, beautiful heart. And I enjoyed that. And also NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte, who's been terrific. He's been a friend of mine, used to be right here running this wonderful country. Now is the NATO Secretary General, is doing a fantastic job, and the Prime Minister.
Look out now, we're ready to jump, because the rhythm is jumping, jump session. Rhythm is jumping, jump session. Rhythm is jumping, jump session. Jump session.